Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Smith and Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you, and we've got a special one for you this week. We are going to have one guest for the entire show. He's a guest that has joined us before, and you know him as a former Toronto Raptors assistant coach, but also one of the best broadcasters out there right now on radio and TV, and one of the all-time great coaches in the NCAA and former head coach in the NBA as well. We bring into the conversation to talk a lot about the NCAA and a whole lot more, P.J. Carlissimo.
P.J., always great to have you on, man. And Eric says, old people now, we shake our fist at the cloud. And Jack Armstrong calls us cane wavers. And I always use the get off my lawn hashtag. So you know what? I'm going to get right into it. And I know the Final Four is just concluded. But I want to look back. 35 years ago, 1989, you took Seton Hall to the Final Four. And I'll give you a little background. I was cheering for anybody but Duke. And when you guys played them on the Saturday, I think they jumped out like 25-8 on you guys or something. And I was like
26, oh, I hate to tell you. Enough.
Okay.
We were 18 down. I remember vividly being 18 down.
I remember 25-8 sitting there because I was in a hospital emergency room having stitches put in. And I said, can you put the game up? And they put the game on CBS. And I looked and I started cursing the TV. I'm like, geez, they're down to, like, not Duke again. I got to hear about Danny Ferry and Coach K and, oh, please, not Duke again. And you guys, first of all, PJ, tell me about the comeback in that game. Because it's not like it was an era where we're in now, where it was up and down, there was a whole bunch of possessions. You guys methodically and systematically pulled yourselves up and ended up winning that game.
Well, it did take a while, but beginning of the game, it was really the only time all year where our guys might have been, you know, you wonder what it's like. I still live in Seattle. Of course, the Kingdome's not here anymore, but you wonder, we talked about it last week, you know, what it's like for people playing in front of 70,000 people, and the young kid for the freshman from UConn is the best player in the game the first 5 minutes of the game in their semifinal. So you just wonder how your guys are going to react. It might have been the only time in the postseason where we were a little shook. And Danny Ferry, who was the player of the year in college basketball, a lot of people forget, was playing out of his mind. We had Darrell Walker was our best defensive big. And, I mean, you know, he'd played great players the whole year and all through the tournament. And it didn't matter whatever we did against Danny. It didn't matter. Danny was just, you know, scoring at will. And there was a timeout, immediate timeout, or we took a timeout. I don't remember it, at 26-8. And for whatever reason, we settled down from that point on. And it took a while. I mean, I think we still trailed at the half. But clearly by the half, we were back in the game and we were in good shape. Like, we felt it was anybody's game at halftime. And second half, we just completely dominated. It used to be, I don't know, it might still be, the biggest turnaround ever in a Final Four game, because we ended up winning by it was really a deceptive score. It was a much better
for
game.
Fun. Yeah.
When you see the score, you say, wow, it was a kill. What a bad game. And it was the opposite of that. And Robert Bricky, who was one of their better players, a starter, kind of a, we'd call him a 3-and-D now, but a really tough player, good player. He got injured. He drove baseline at one point. Gerald Green was playing him. It had to be a switch because Gerald doesn't normally play. Gerald was a point guard. But as he was playing Robert, and Robert was driving along the right baseline, Gerald hit him with the knee, you know, a Charlie horse, kind of on the side or, you know, up high in his leg. And he either didn't come back in the game at all, or when he came back, he could hardly move. And that was significant. That was a starter and a good player for Duke. He went out of the game. So the combination of Danny Ferry, frankly, got exhausted. We did the one thing. We always had a lot of bigs. We were, back in those days, we played two bigs. We started a 5 and a 4, and they were both, it was Ramon Ramos and Darrell Walker, and we had off the bench Anthony Avent and Franz Volsi. I mean, they were all quality bigs, like 6'8 or bigger. I mean, Anthony and Ramon Ramos, Anthony did have a good NBA career. Ramon Ramos would have had were it not for the horrible automobile accident he got in when he was a rookie in Portland. So we had a lot of bodies to throw at Danny, and eventually he just got tired, to be honest with you. And we kind of wore him down, and our team was a really good team. We were deep. We had just beaten Vegas, UNLV, and Indiana in the West region in Denver. At the time, it was their two worst losses, two biggest losses either of them ever had. I think it obviously was both double-digit losses in Denver, and we just, you know, we pulled away at the end, and then we ended up doing the same thing and pulling away from Duke in the semifinal. But again, we had, I think we had nine seniors on the team if you counted walk-ons. So it was very much a veteran team. The one new face was arguably one of the best players, Andrew Gaze from Australia. And Andrew and Ramon Ramos had just come back from Seoul, Korea, in September, where they played in the Olympics. You know, Andrew for Australia and Ramon for Puerto Rico. So, I mean, we had a veteran team. We had two teams we couldn't beat were Pitt and Syracuse. We ended up the year with seven losses. Three of them were to Pittsburgh. Two, because we lost to them in the Big East also. Two to Syracuse. We lost at Georgetown was our sixth loss. And our only non-Big East loss the entire year was Michigan in the championship game. And, I mean, that's how good the conference was then. In fact, we won on a Saturday in Denver. Us and Michigan both won on Saturday. I forget where Michigan was playing, but we both won on Saturday. And I remember talking to Jim Boeheim that night. They were playing Illinois the next day, and Georgetown was playing Duke, and Duke was not favored. It was in the Meadowlands.
That was in New Jersey. Yeah. And
we
PJ?
Thought it was a chance. It was going to be another three teams in the Final Four like it happened.
Yeah.
In 85 with Villanova, and, like, you know, we were the one that weren't expected to be there, and we thought Syracuse had a great, and Syracuse lost literally. There was a weird play on a free throw. I mean, they might have lost by more than two, but it was a missed free throw rebound at the end of the game that put Illinois in over Syracuse, and Duke upset Georgetown in the Meadowlands. So we went from sitting there Saturday in Denver saying, wow, there's going to be three Big East teams in the Final Four, so we ended up being the only Big East team in the Final Four.
Well, Quinn Snyder was on that Duke team, right, that upset Georgetown.
Exactly.
I remember because he's going home. And that was the call from Brent Musburger that Quinn was going back to Washington. And I remember Michigan beat Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, because we were at that regional.
I didn't remember who Fish beat.
Mark and I.
Was a great, great game.
Mark and I drove to Lexington. We drove to Lexington to watch Michigan. John Crotty was playing for Virginia with Brian Stith.
Yep.
And North Carolina was there with Jeff Lebo and company. And
oh,
the last
boy.
Team in that regional was Mookie Blaylock, Stacey King in Oklahoma.
So
Michigan,
yep.
Michigan came out of a tough one too. And PJ, I'll tell you this, and we've always had a great relationship. I got to tell you, I was coaching the Ontario Provincial team that year. I mean, you know, you were up at our practice a couple of days later to try and recruit. And I took all of your stuff from Seton Hall, how you guys ran the UCLA classic guard-to-guard entry, shuffle cut, weak side duck in, high post down, or strong side down. We took it all, and I drilled those kids that summer on that thing. And we won our Canadian championship as the province of Ontario. We won by 54 in the final game.
Well, John Wooden knew what he was doing. He won enough championships. So I figured if it worked for John Wooden for about 100 championships, it would be okay for us. But it was good. I remember I forget whether they split during the regular season or Illinois had beaten them twice. But the Michigan-Illinois game was a great game in the semi. I mean, you combine that game. Our game was a one-point game in overtime, the championship game. And the Duke game, despite the score, was an interesting game. You know, a lot of people were saying this was one of the better Final Fours in terms of quality of the games. People weren't getting up early and leaving. They were really good games. But, teams were just so different, Eric and Jonesy, in those days. I mean, Michigan had Ramil Robinson, Lloyd Vaught, Terry Mills, Glenn Rice. I forget the fifth starter was a really good player. I'm drawing a blank.
I think it was Higgins, wasn't it? Sean Higgins?
Yes. Sean might have been off the bench, believe it or not. The other guy might have started, and Sean might have been young and come off the bench. But Illinois had three pros on their team. I mean, it was unbelievable. But, you know, in those days, guys, for the most part, stayed 3 or 4 years in college, you know, and you had four-year teams. You had teams that had been together for that long, and you had men, I'm not being smart, but as opposed to today, you had 22-year-old guys, 21, 22. You know, if a kid had a medical redshirt, he'd been 23 years playing. So it was just, it was night and day different, the quality of the college teams in those days versus today, where if you're even a, you know, borderline good player, you're gone in a year, or you start, you know, now with the new portal, you start transferring left and right. I mean, now I use my orange magic marker just for transfer, like from the different schools, the players. I can't even keep track. You know, you have a kid and you start saying, well, he transferred from this and that and that, and they're playing. But heck, it works. Danny didn't have a lot of transfers, but the ones he had were really, really good. And yeah, Cam Spencer, I didn't realize how good a player Cam Spencer was. I knew he was a great shooter. He rebounded, he passed, he defended. He's a heck of a player. I think he spent 3 years at Loyola Maryland in the Patriot League, where, you know, our son Kyle's playing now for Colgate, and then a year at Rutgers before he gets to UConn. And he's obviously a key player on this team this year. But it's a different era, and then you have different quality teams, I think, than we had in the old days.
So we're about 17 minutes and 30 seconds into the interview. I'm going to ask a question now. This is the easiest interview I've ever had a chance to do. This is fantastic. I love it. I love it.
Hey, and I got to tell you, PJ's going pretty good, and there has been no red wine involved that I know of.
It's an afternoon delight maybe somewhere. We'll see. PJ, I wanted to go back to, you were talking about the halftime and the turnaround, specifically about Duke, and whether PJ, you want to handle this directly about that game or more philosophically from any game, from any coach, pro, college, or otherwise. We often talk about as broadcasters,
philosophically, because I don't remember the specifics, to be honest.
Okay,
with you.
Perfect.
You guys are saying you're old. I'm beyond senility here, so.
So philosophically, then, and you've probably talked about it even as an analyst now in the broadcasting side of things. We'll say, oh, the paint's going to be peeled off the wall at half, or on a positive note, team goes into the half, hey, they just wish they could keep playing. They don't even want to go into the locker room. They don't even want to talk. As a coach, how do you decide what to say, when to say it, how to say it, the tone to use, the message to deliver, when you need to be hard, when you need to be soft? Like, how do you feel that out as a coach with your players, pro or college, and when you need to strike or when you need to have just, again, that soft approach?
Well, I think it's a combination of – it's a lot of factors, obviously, but the simplest answer I can come up with, the first thing is you got to be you. You can't not be what you are. And that kind of trumps the whole thing. You know, I mean, how are you with them always? You know, I mean, over the course of the year, you can't change who you are. And you know, there are some guys that literally blister their guys all the time. You make a mistake, you get on them, and that's the way it is. And they're consistent. They'll do that in an NCAA game. They'll do it in the biggest game of the year. They'll do it in a meaningless non-conference road game against a team they should be killing. But most people are more a mix, and it's the mix where it comes into making the kind of decisions you're talking about. Like, what does your team look like? Are they shook up? Are they intimidated by this other team? Are you on the road and the crowd has really gotten to them? Or are they just, you know, taking a night off? Like, I don't know if you guys watched any of the Phoenix Clipper game. Yeah, I like to watch games after they're over so I can fast forward, you know, tape them and fast forward and stuff. I turned it on. I couldn't believe it. It was something to four, and they didn't score. At one point, it was 30-4 in the first half. It was the Phoenix first quarter. It was the Phoenix Suns against the Clippers in Phoenix. I'm like, holy God. Like, you know, a game like that is simple. You go insane. There's nothing else you can do because there's no excuse. They weren't ready to play. But, I mean, so many times it's the look in your players' eyes, and all during the course of the first half or the first two quarters, if it's NBA or women's basketball. You know, what's going on? Are they just not focused? They're not ready to play? Are they tired? It's NBA or, yeah, on a back-to-back or something like that, and you're just saying, hey, I can't beat a dead horse. These guys are trying. There's no gas in the tank. We're in the wrong place on the wrong night, and sometimes you absorb one of those beatings. So I think that's part of, people would probably resent me calling it an art, but that's part of the art of coaching. What is going to get through to your guys that night? And again, if they're used to you being hard, being on them, you know, going in and like, you know, fake positive, come on guys, we're okay. They're like, you know, who's this? What's he talking about? Players know when they don't play well. NBA, it's a little tougher because the coach in college is the king. And, you know, for the most part, a lot of players make their decisions based on who the coach is. They go there to play for a particular coach. And the coach in college is the GM. He's the scout. He's everything. He handpicks them. He brings them in. Once you've been at a place for a couple of years, you know, you're the dominant personality. So, you know, you can say to players whatever you think is appropriate. The NBA is the opposite of that. The NBA is a players' league. You can go to the wall every once in a while and blast somebody. And again, different coaches are different. Nick Nurse is different than Darko is different than, me is different than Lenny Wilkins. Well, you know, there's guys that are perceived to be players' coaches and you don't see them getting on them. And then there's other guys that people think Pop yells all the time because they see him occasionally going what he calls Serbian on the sideline, but he doesn't do that very often. But when he needs to, he can get away with it. There's no, like, none of the players are like, you know, he can't talk to me like that. No, there's none of that there. You know, some other guys, young guys in the league, new guys in the league, people that don't do a real good relationships with their players, they got to be careful because you can lose not just the locker room. You know, you can not just a player, you can lose a locker room, and then it gets hard when you speak with people. So, I mean, clearly the NBA, you have to tread a little bit lightly. But if you look around the 30 coaches in the league and you can kind of picture from the way they are on the sideline, like what they're going to be like, and you can look at enough huddles with TV and see different people are different. And again, that's part of the art. Some nights one thing's going to work. Some nights another thing's going to work. Some nights it doesn't matter what you say. You know, you might as well just, you're talking to the moon. You're not going to get through, and it's just not there on a given night. But hopefully over the course of a year, and particularly, again, in the old days in college, when you have guys for years and you've got a veteran team, like right now, Dan Hurley had a couple new guys on the team, but essentially he had a lot of holdovers from last year. So, I mean, did he coach a little differently? Yeah, a little bit differently. But, I mean, that was his team, and he rode them pretty hard. That's just his style. That's the way he coaches. Matt Painter's a little quieter. Now, Matt's direct also. He's just quietly direct. Like, if Zach Edey does something wrong, Matt calls him on it, you know, right there in front of the team. I mean, I got a chance to go to all the practices at the Final Four, and, again, both of those guys obviously are good friends for a long time. So you see the way people are, but most people that are successful have to be direct, have to call. When their best player makes a mistake, you got to tell them. In the NBA, sometimes that's hard. There's a couple, you know, there's some teams and there's some players in the NBA that you got to tread very, very softly when you call them on what their mistake is. And maybe you don't call them as much in front of the team. It's more, you know, one-on-one, and that's the bigger challenge, I think, of the NBA is handling the personalities and handling the egos and realizing, you know, that some of the guys you're coaching are making 10 times what you're making. And it's never a difficult decision for a owner or a GM to make when normally if you have a confrontation between a player and a coach, that decision usually takes about 5 seconds to make about which salary we can afford to pay off and which one we can't. So coaching in the NBA is difficult.
PJ, I mean, Matt played for Gene Katie, so we know how direct he can be.
Yep.
And listen, there's a couple of ways I want to go with you here. two things really are burning me to ask you and to get your opinion on. One, Eric and I have talked about this. One is Zach, and how can he, I mean, if it's 20 years ago, he's the number one pick without question, 25 years ago. But there are people doubting his ability to play in the NBA because of the way the game is being played now. And like Eric brought up a good point. He said, is he at least as good as Ivica Zubac? I mean, I still think there's a place for a big guy in this game. He knows the game. He's more of an NBA project than he is a basketball project. So, I mean, I think he can play. And the other thing that comes to mind, PJ, is you talk about coaches, the whole triangle between Cal, Arkansas, and Kentucky now, and, you know, who steps into that high-pressure job, because that's not an easy place. Start with Zach for me, and let me know what you think there, first of all.
It sounds like I'm with you. I'm a minority opinion on Zach. I think Zach can play in the NBA, not for 30 teams, but there's some teams that, like people say, well, he can't go out and, you know, guard the pick and roll, and it's going to be really hard for him to get up and down the floor. So, you know, what do you do with him? He can't play. He's skilled. What do you do with him when they throw him the ball underneath and he scores, or if he's able to rebound, even just standing on his tiptoes? Down in there. When we had our Arvydas Sabonis, and again, it was a long time ago, in Portland, he was very late in his career. You're talking a guy that was a really athletic, more athletic than Domantas is right now, frankly. But he was still really effective for us. He got beat up and down the floor sometimes, and going out and trapping pick and rolls was certainly not his forte, but he defended Shaq as well as anybody in the league could defend one-on-one because of his size and his physicality. I have a hunch that there's some NBA team that's just listening and shaking their head like everybody else. Like, yeah, no, he wouldn't go before 20 or 18 or 14 or whatever it is. And I think somebody's going to take him sooner than that and say, we'll take a chance with him. All right. We know all the things he can't do. We also know the things he can do. So I like him. That is clearly a minority opinion. Most of the people I talked to in the NBA say, no way, no how can he play. I think he does too many things well that take the things he does well and don't worry about the other things. And again, there's 30 teams. It's not like every team has a really mobile five and a really good four. Like, you know, they make it sound like every five in the league shoots threes and can run like a deer and jump, and every four, you know, is more a three than a four. That's not the case. There are some great fours and great fives that nobody can guard. Nikola Jokic is not exactly a gazelle getting up and down the floor. He doesn't exactly get off his feet all that well, but he's the best player in the NBA. He's the best player in the world. So, you know, you don't have to look too far to find somebody who doesn't fit the mold that everybody assumes you have to be. Now, I'm not saying Zach's in that category. I don't think anybody's in his category, but I think Zach has a chance. I really do. I'm going to be surprised if somebody doesn't roll the dice with him. The other situation, I have no clue. I talked to Cal when I was in Phoenix. We have a thing called the Final Four Coaches Club, which is a great little luncheon held Saturday afternoon before the semis, where the coaches go, and if your team makes the Final Four, you get presented with it's a simple blue blazer, very nice, and it's not even logoed on the outside. You wouldn't know it. It's just a tradition. Brian Dutcher got his this year, but it's great because the only people that go to this luncheon are former Final Four coaches. And I talked to Cal, and he was going to come, wasn't going to come. He didn't tell me why, but obviously it was because he was engaged otherwise. And I saw his son Brad during the Final Four and talked to him. So John Calipari is a great hire. At Arkansas, I see the way it was going. Could John have salvaged it? In my opinion, yeah, absolutely. I actually thought this was going to be a good Kentucky run in the NCAA this year. I did not expect to see them knocked off when they were. I thought this was a chance that had a chance to win three or two for sure, maybe three games in the tournament. And it wouldn't have shocked me if John stayed at Kentucky if he had a great team next year. Having said that, yeah, the people were getting impatient, upset, call it whatever the heck you want. It's not a bad move for John to go to Arkansas. It's a great hire for Arkansas. I was a little surprised when Musk left to go to USC, but because I thought he was doing a good job at at Arkansas. He's another former NBA guy, ironically. Kentucky, what direction did they go? I haven't read the papers. When we were in Phoenix, which was just a couple days ago, it was Billy Donovan or Danny or Jay Wright were the three names that were being bandied about. I don't know if any of the three would be not a good hire. It would be a great hire. I'm not sure any of the three have any interest whatsoever, which is hard to imagine. Because, you know, there's a time when Kentucky was considered the best job or one of the two or three best jobs in all of basketball. But they'll get somebody good for sure. And Mitch is smart enough to not be rushed into a decision. But I'm sure they've already had conversations with whoever their top two or three guys are. And it's an absolute no-excuse job. I mean, there's nothing that's missing from there.
PJ, I'm going to kind of throw this really open-ended to you because, you know, I could probably get a little more technical and ask you a little more directly. But when it comes to John Calipari leaving and players entering transfer portals and the NIL and all the other things that are going on now in college basketball, how different do you think it would be right now if you were to rewind or fast-forward the clock and go back to when you were coaching and trying to deal with all of the stuff that now goes into the NCAA from a player's perspective, let alone a coach's perspective, because it's wild and confusing and infuriating and exciting all at the same time.
Eric, it's the Wild West. I've heard it referred to that more times by coaches. I still do. I do Pac-12 Network, and of course ESPN is kind enough to let me go for 3.5 weeks to do the entire I do the Pac-12 tournament usually, and then the 3 weeks of the NCAA. So I still am in touch with a lot of college coaches. I see a lot of college practices. My son is a sophomore at Colgate, so that also keeps me involved. It's been said to me, if it's been once, it's been 50 times. Boy, you cannot imagine how hard this job is now, how different it is than when I was in it. Now, again, when I was in it, it's a long time ago. 94 is when I left college, but a lot of my friends were still in it until a couple years ago. But like you start, you know, naming the Krzyzewskis, the Boeheims, the Calhouns, the different coaches that have gotten out of it just recently that were good friends of mine that coached for the longest time and coached really successfully. They were 70 and still coaching and still doing really well. It's just changed so much. The combination of the portal, which just makes it really hard to coach young players. And I mean, they're not happy. They're not happy if they're not getting enough playing time. They're not happy if they're not getting enough shots, and they always think it's greener somewhere else. And they're being told that, frankly, they're being recruited. Guys have told me stories about, you know, and we didn't always do it in the old days, especially in the Big East. You know, when a game's over, they line up and the two teams are shaking hands with each other, starting with the coaches, and then there's like a line and everybody shakes hands. Guys are telling me, like, assistant coaches are telling players, like, when they get down to the end of the line, hey, things don't work out, give me a call. And like, that they're like almost recruiting in the shake hands line at the end of games. I mean, it's gotten ridiculous. They allowed transfers in within leagues. It wasn't allowed when I was there. You weren't allowed to transfer within a league. And people are saying, well, that's un-American or un-Canadian, if you will. You can't tell them they can't transfer. Why can't you? You know, you made your own rules. Colleges could make whatever rules they had, and it did that, and that helped some sanity in your league. You didn't have guys fighting with each other about, hey, you stole my guy, the stuff that's going on now. And then you put the NIL on top of that, and again, same thing, a litany of coaches saying, well, Joe Jones came in to me at the end of the year and said he needs $200,000 if he's coming back, because he can get $250,000 somewhere else. I want to stay here, coach, but I need more money than I got this year. I mean, are you kidding me? It's just impossible. So you make the best of it. You do what you can. And, I mean, there's obviously guys like Danny Hurley and a whole bunch of other guys who seem to figure it out year in and year out. Jonesy's favorite team, John Shire, is not having any problems, advancing and doing well at Duke. But it's hard to come up with any rule that is still going to change the pecking order. That, you know, the glamour programs, the programs with the most whatever, be it facilities, be it NIL money, be it tradition, be it the league they're in, be it, you know, the good players they already have. The rich are going to get richer. You're not going to change that. And it's just, it's tough. It's tough nowadays. It really is. It certainly is not the college landscape that I left. And there's certainly a lot of coaches who are not happy with the way it is now, for sure. And it's not an accident. I the guys I listed were the oldest guys, because those were the guys that were coaching when I was there. But again, they were still thriving, you know, for the most part, right up until the end. And there's a number of guys, again, very successful coaches right now that are not long for the game. I mean, one out of every four practices I go to, if it's a veteran coach, one of the first things that, you know, he says to me, I'm only going to do this another year, so I can't handle it anymore. It's not as enjoyable. It's not supposed to be easy. It's not supposed to be like, you know, fun. You're jumping up and down. You're so happy. It's, you know, what you're doing. But I mean, I like coaching. I like going to work every day. I enjoyed it. And I had a lot of bad years, and, you know, I coached a lot of bad teams along the way, but I enjoyed what I was doing. But I also felt that, you know, for the most part, I had some control over it. You know, when I didn't have good teams, I hadn't recruited well, or I hadn't coached well, or whatever. There's a lot of guys that just feel now their control is very, very tentative, if that. It's different. The landscape has changed completely. You know, again, the beginning of this year, when the SEC coaches, football coaches, were complaining about NIL, I'm shaking my head going, well, that's it. If those guys don't like it, who in their right mind could like it, other than SEC football coaches? So I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder if the next 2-3 years we start going back in the other direction with either NIL or transfer portal, whether there'll be some changes. But, you know, if there's anything that's cut back, there's going to be a lawsuit like the next week from some player somewhere. I mean, you got the Dartmouth kids wanting to unionize. You have Raekwon Battle, who was here as a UW player, ended up at Montana State, played for Danny Sprinkle, and then ended up at West Virginia this year, and then had a lawsuit to be able to play again. So some judge somewhere is going to throw out whatever changes the NCAA may want to make in the future. So it's really hard to stomach it, to be honest with you. And I don't think it's for the better. I'm always a curmudgeon, and I like the old days for sure. But I mean, they're how we got to where we are now, I don't know. But anybody that's going to argue that it's better than it was, college athletics, they're out of their mind.
PJ, I think there are some things that are good that that some of the kids, you know, get a piece of the pie.
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Not for the transferring, yep, all around. And I think the only positive spinoff that comes from this, other than that, the kids getting a share and all of that, I mean, that's something that I'd always talked about. Like, I was waiting for the day when the Final Four didn't go, because the four teams full of, you know, the 50 kids stood in the locker room and said, no, until we get a cut of the 90,000-seat gate, we're not going out there. So, I mean, I think this part of it is good. The only other spinoff that might be good is, because of the NIL, kids will stay in school longer, and the NBA game gets better because you've got – I look at a kid like Zach Edey, as we talked about. He knows the game now, and what you teach him, the same way you did, PJ, when you were coaching in Portland or Golden State, what you're now teaching is not basketball, but you're teaching the nuances of the NBA game, as opposed to teaching him how to jump stop or bounce pass or doing the rudimentary and elementary things that you have to do now with some one-and-done kids that come into the pros.
How to act with money in your pocket when you're traveling all over the country, and there's nobody waking you up, and nobody making you go to class, and nobody making you do other things. It's night and day. The thing, though, that Jonesy, it annoys me when people say that. They talk about those 50 kids in the locker room like they're deprived. An average scholarship is about $250,000 or $300,000. If you're a husband or a wife sending your kid to school, and you're writing checks that over the course of your son or daughter's college experience, be it 4 or 5 years, is somewhere between $200,000 and $400,000. They're not getting nothing.
I know.
They're getting scholarships that nobody even talks about. They're getting degrees that nobody even talks about. They make it sound like every single player has a chance to play in the NBA or the NFL or NHL. It's stupidity. And a lot of that money that the schools were realizing, you want to say the coaches are getting too much money? Fine. I'm not gonna argue that. I was one of those coaches that got a lot of money. But a lot of that money that goes to each school, that pays the scholarships for all the other non-revenue sports, the Olympic sports, all the other ones that are now just completely lost in the shuffle because we got leagues with 18 and 20 teams in them because of football. We should have let football go its own way. They stayed in college, everything. They should have just had different rules for football. And everything else, I think, could have worked out. We see what's happening now with women's basketball. It's great. Are they ever going to generate enough money to help, you know, the rest of the programs? I don't know. I doubt that. I still think the Iowas and even South Carolinas are, you know, Stanford, Connecticut, take your pick. I think they're the exceptions for now. But the amount of money that an NCAA collegiate student gets when they get a scholarship, particularly a full scholarship, and there's a lot of those full scholarships funded by football and basketball, you know, like I you see these people standing up going, these kids are getting deprived. Whoa, wait a minute. Let's start with they have a $250,000 scholarship. They have their education paid for, room, board, tuition, books, and fees. Don't tell me they're not getting anything. You know, and that's a big misnomer. You never, ever hear. Our biggest selling point when we went in, sat in the living room with parents was, we're giving your son a scholarship until he graduates from Seton Hall for 4 or 5 years. I can guarantee you he's going to get an education. Playing time's up to him. My assistants used to shake their head and go, why are you telling stuff like that? You know, I said, hey, if he works hard, he's going to play. If he doesn't, the guy next to him is going to play. But he's got a scholarship for $250,000 or $300,000. That's completely lost in the shuffle now. And getting a degree is completely lost in the shuffle, as if we have, you know, hundreds of players every year good enough to play in the NBA. I mean, 60 get drafted, and a lot of those 60 don't make it, you know, to the NBA, or if they make it for a cup of coffee. So the degree is still really important, and I never, ever hear it mentioned anymore.
PJ, last one for me, and I want to switch gears just to the NBA to close it out, at least for me here, because you mentioned Nikola Jokic earlier. And I promise you, you've known me and certainly Jonesy long enough. I'm being honest here. I'm checking the Canadian passport at the door. I promise you this has got nothing to do with patriotism or anything else.
Yep.
Up until about a week or two ago, I would have said, and I know Jonesy said the same thing, that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was my MVP. If I had a vote, I'm giving it to Shai because nobody under the sun had any fathom of any clue that Oklahoma City was going to be this good. And I know Chet's had a solid season, but OKC having a chance to finish number one in the Western Conference, even with the 1 week to go here, to me, Shai is deserving of the spot. Now, that said, he missed a couple of games. We saw how bad Oklahoma City looked without him, but still, it's no denying that Jokic has been unbelievable, and it seems like it's probably his award to lose yet again. Are we wrong for that? Do you think there's any chance that Jokic doesn't win it? And where would you have Shai if you were throwing in your ballot today?
I'd have Shai 1A. I don't think there's any chance he's going to win it. I just think that I have no idea, but just based on the little I read, the little I hear, you know, like over the course of the year, they do all those polls or whatever the hell. ESPN's probably the biggest offender, the ranking. I just read something last night. I was looking for the standings, and I read something. I'm trying to think of who the hell it was. Somebody, it was like, again, fairly convincing argument. It wasn't Shai. It was who else is listed? It listed somebody else should get it, and I'm going.
Luka. Luka and Tatum are both up there as well.
No, that's what it was. It was Luka. Right. It was like, look at the way Dallas is playing. Luka does more for his team, and I'm like, my head's hurting, going, whoa. I just don't see it. I understand the Shai argument totally. And if Shai got it, I wouldn't say, well, you know, this is wrong. If Luka gets it, I'm going to say, are you kidding me? come on, he's not the MVP in the NBA this year. If Shea got it, I think most people would say, no problem with that. I can understand him getting it. I had problems with Joel getting it last year. I don't care how many years he's played well and all that stuff. I don't think he was the MVP. Where Denver is right now, and I figure most people wait on their ballots till they send them in. I think my sense is it's going to be Nikola. But, as you guys well know, I've been wrong so many times, it's not even funny. But SGA, I could see that argument. Luka, I have trouble with the argument or anybody else. I know it's been a heck of a year, and there's a lot of players. The people in Boston are probably diving on the radio, turning it off right now. We're not even talking about Jason Tatum. But I still lean Nikola. SGA to me would be 1A, and nobody else to me is in the conversation.
PJ, I'm a Shea guy because of what Eric and I talked about, just the way Oklahoma City's come up. And last one for me here on the NBA playoffs and the play-in tournament. I think Adam Silver's got to be rubbing his hands together, knowing that he's got exactly what he wants. Two nights ago, 13 of the 14 games, Eric and I did, Toronto, Indiana. And the only game was San Antonio, Memphis that didn't have seeding implications. I mean, last night you had Durant before the win, or before the game, you had Durant, LeBron, Steph, all in the play-in. And if we'd been under the old system, LeBron and Steph would be out. So it's prevented exactly the tanking. And the excitement now, PJ, I'm looking forward to the March Madness one-and-done scenario next week with probably LeBron playing Steph and maybe the winner of that having to beat Durant to get in just to get a seven-game series. The NBA's got to be thrilled with this, PJ.
Adams, there's no question. I didn't think it was, all that great in my eyes. I said, it's okay. It keeps a couple more teams in. I never thought it would be as dramatically impactful as it has been. I say the same thing about the in-season tournament. When they did the in-season tournament and juggled the schedule and did all the things they did, which kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit, I'm waiting for some comments on that. Like, hey, wait a minute. This in-season tournament caused some inequities in the schedule that now, have denied somebody a seeding position or even an entry into the playoffs. I'm waiting for that. But when we were in Las Vegas in December, I could not believe how important to the players the in-season tournament was. So hats off to Adam. I watched his press conference yesterday after the meeting with the board. And, selfishly, I still live in Seattle. My kingdom's not here, but I'm waiting because Adam said numerous times, once we get the new media rights deal done, the next thing we're going to talk about is expansion. Didn't guarantee it, but so people here, people in Vancouver, people in Las Vegas, certainly in Mexico City. I mean, I think Louisville, I'm sure I'm slighting a city or two along the way, but that's going to be interesting if they talk about expanding. I just didn't see that coming. Like, people here in Seattle have been furious since 07-08, which was the last year we were here when KD and Jeff Green were rookies here, and the team the next year moved to OKC. And, there's still a lot of people that can't believe that Vancouver and Seattle, lost their franchises, or however you want to phrase it. That was when I was in the league, and, they were both here, and they were two of everybody's favorite cities to visit, to play in. I just think that, Seattle mishandled it. It was the amount of things Seattle did wrong to lose the team was their own fault. It was terrible. Vancouver, I just think this is me from the outside. They pulled the plug too soon. I still think that was going to be a very viable NBA franchise had they stayed with it a little bit longer. That city, we live so close to it. That is such a great city. And, everybody would love to see Vancouver back in the NBA.
PJ, I was gonna wrap it right there. We've talked about this many times, myself and Jonesy, with other guests in the past. But my only problem is I just don't think the NBA will go back to both cities, and I think Seattle is going to get it before Vancouver does. So I think the ship has sailed on Vancouver, sadly, because I think they never should have lost it, and I'd love to see them get a second chance, but I don't see the league going two teams in the Pacific Northwest.
I don't disagree with that, for sure. I just hope maybe they expand one more time. A week doesn't go by, I don't see somebody say, we're so upset we don't come to Seattle or Vancouver. They always include the two for just what you're talking about. I mean, that used to be the swing. You'd play, you'd play some two of Portland, Vancouver, and Seattle when you were up here. And it was, it was the toughest travel in the league, along with Miami and Orlando. You didn't want to be in either of those two corners because your travel was so much more difficult. You spent more hours on planes and you had more long trips. But again, it was Portland's thrive. Portland hasn't, it hasn't gone anywhere as long as they've been in it. But it's sad that Seattle and Vancouver don't have franchises right now. And we'll see if there's expansion. I'm going to be shocked, as I think everybody will be, if Vegas isn't one of the teams in. And then after that, who knows?
PJ, appreciate the time. Really do. And you're always great to us. And we'll look forward to chatting again soon. All the best.
Eric Jonesy, great being with you. Thanks very much.
One. Always great to catch up, Jonesy, with PJ Carlissimo again, former Raptors assistant coach and longtime NBA head coach, and of course, longtime NCAA head coach as well, touching on a number of topics from the NBA and even more so the NCAA, with March Madness wrapping up a little more than a week ago. And now we, of course, are eyeing the NBA postseason. The Raptors not a part of it, but still plenty of storylines for basketball fans in Southern Ontario, in Canada, and across the globe to be excited about. And we will talk about the playoffs on next week's edition of Smith & Jones. Fresh content every Thursday, and you can always catch the podcast, whether it be the most current one or catch up on old ones, on your favorite podcast platform, Google, Apple, Spotify, or otherwise. Download, subscribe, rate, and review, and also share it, folks. We appreciate you sharing along to your friends and family. For producer and technical director Austin Mackey, for Paul Jones, I'm Eric Smith. Thanks for tuning in to Smith & Jones.